Chapter 16. Kremlin Ink. A week before the second runoff of Ukraine's presidential election in December 2004, Russia dismantled Yukos Oil. In his public remarks ever since the affair began, Putin had insisted that the Kremlin had no intention of doing so, and many people, the other tycoons, foreign investors, ordinary Russians, had believed him. They assumed that even if the entire prosecution stemmed from some animosity toward Khodorkovsky, Putin would not destroy the country's richest company. As the prosecutorial assault continued on Khodorkovsky and Yukos itself, however, it became harder for Putin to protest his innocence or to deny what was becoming obvious. He may not have initiated the criminal and tax charges against Yukos, according to one Kremlin official, but at some point, he moved from observer to participant, and then the leader of the final demolition of the company and the redistribution of its richest asset, the crown jewel of its oil empire. Yugansniftegaz was Yukos' main production unit. It was located on a tributary of the Ob River in western Siberia. The first wells were tapped during the Soviet oil boom of the 1960s, but production had steadily declined over time, grossly mismanaged in the years before and after the Soviet collapse. Khodorkovsky's bank acquired the project as part of the notorious Shares for Loans deal that protected Yeltsin's presidency. The bank's investors paid a mere $150 million for Yugansniftegaz, and after a turbulent few years, they brought in foreign expertise and technology to turn it around. By the time of Khodorkovsky's arrest, it was producing 60% of the company's oil. The Ministry of Justice announced that it would seize and auction off Yugansniftegaz only 5 days after the trial of Mikhail Khodorkovsky and his partner Platon Lebedev opened in July 2004 inside a tiny, heavily guarded courtroom in northern Moscow. The prosecutors had not yet finished their opening arguments on the 11 criminal charges Khodorkovsky faced, let alone convicted him of any wrongdoing. But the expropriation of the company's most valuable asset would not wait. Khodorkovsky's supporters gathered outside to protest on the day his trial began and would reappear periodically for the next 10 months, even though the proceedings already seemed a foregone conclusion. The trial was so riddled with procedural violations, including harassment of the defendants and witnesses, as well as their lawyers, that it was reminiscent of a Soviet show trial. And like those earlier trials, the prosecutorial spectacle sent an intended chill through the political and economic elite, silencing even the few voices willing to speak out after Khodorkovsky's arrest. Other major oil companies moved quickly to forswear the sort of tricks Yukos used to lower its taxes, and instead took to boasting about how much in taxes they were willing to pay. Except for Khodorkovsky's supporters, his spokespeople, his investors, his lawyers, his friends and family, fewer and fewer dared to openly confront Putin's Kremlin on any issue. "I'm very scared to name names now," Arkady Volsky, the head of the Industrialists Union, told a television network, saying he knew who was behind the Yukos affair. "I'm simply scared. I have 6 grandchildren, after all, and I want them to be alive." For such candor, he was promptly replaced as the head of the union. Publicly, Putin maintained his distance from the proceedings, as if he did not approve them. The decision to seize and auction Yukos's subsidiary, however, made it clear that removing Khodorkovsky from public life was no longer the sole objective. The breakup of Yukos itself now seemed inevitable, and a decision of that magnitude could only be made at the top. The subsidiary's value far exceeded the $3.4 billion that the company allegedly owed the state for having underpaid its taxes. Yukos had already begun paying that debt in hopes of saving itself, but the tax authorities announced new audits and new fines for underpaying taxes in subsequent years and rebuffed efforts by Yukos's managers to negotiate any payment plan. The debt soon ballooned to $24 billion, more than the company's remaining worth. Putin had no interest in winning back taxes for the country's flush coffers, He wanted the asset itself. On November 18th, Russia's property fund announced the opening price for bids on Yugansknyftegaz at $8.65 billion, considerably less than the valuation of $18 billion to $21 billion made by a German firm, Dresdner Bank, at the government's request. And it set the auction for the earliest date possible under the law, December 19th, and went ahead even though the date fell on a Sunday. The only question was who the buyer would be. As the auction approached, Putin found himself mediating an avaricious struggle among the circle of loyalists whom he had lifted up to be the high officers of the state and industry. He no longer faced significant political challenges outside the Kremlin, but inside the factions closest to him maneuvered like the boyars had under the czars. As with any court, the courtiers often were at odds, but in this case the conflict was not over ideology or vision between the liberals and the Siloviki. This was about money and power. The courtiers circled the wounded Yukos like wolves, anticipating the profits that would come with the company's largest asset. They included some of his most trusted aides, Dmitry Medvedev, and a Politburo of hardliners, Igor Sechin, Viktor Ivanov, and Nikolai Petrushev, who advocated for the strengthening of state control over natural resources. Medvedev had served as chairman of Gazprom since 2000, working to exert greater government control over a company that was technically private, though the state owned 38% of its shares. Putin wanted full control of this energy giant, which possessed nearly a fifth of the world's natural gas reserves and thousands of miles of pipelines that kept much of Europe warm. And his initial plan to accomplish that was to have Gazprom absorb Rosneft, the ailing state company that he had steadily favored with political support and licenses, especially in Chechnya, where no other company dared work after the Second War began. Since Rosneft was wholly owned by the state, the merger would give the Kremlin a controlling stake in an energy juggernaut as rich as Exxon and as pliant as Saudi Arabia's Aramco. The roots of the idea reached back to Putin's days in Petersburg, when he and his friends oversaw provincial business deals and oil trades and wrote academic theses about the necessity of the steady hand of the state. Now, only a few years later, they were on the verge of realizing their vision on a national scale. Putin approved the deal to merge Gazprom and Rosneft in September 2004, the day after he announced the sweeping political changes in the wake of Beslan. It fit a pattern of centralizing control, a steady gathering of more and more power into Putin's hands. The merger proposal, though, delighted investors and analysts, especially foreigners, the same ones who had been so shaken by the tumult in the market as the Yukos case unfolded. The reason was not complicated. There was money to be made. As part of the merger, Putin promised that once the state controlled a majority share of Gazprom, he would lift the restrictions on foreign investors buying minority shares. Although Gazprom was seen as an unwieldy, inefficient behemoth, its monopoly power to sell natural gas and the Kremlin's doting patronage created the prospect of returns enormous enough to tempt even the most jaded investor. Few seemed troubled by Yukos's fate anymore. By some estimates, foreign investment would double Gazprom's market capitalization, with the rising value benefiting thousands of shareholders. A month after the merger was announced, John Brown of BP heaped praise on the direction in which Putin had taken Russia, brushing aside the trepidations many inside and outside the country had about the Kremlin's tactics. "Since Gorbachev, a lot has happened in Russia," he said. "No country has come so far in such a short space of time." As for Yukos, he dismissed the prosecutorial assault on Khodorkovsky and his partners as an isolated matter, related to a person, place, and a time, not to the country's economic future. Putin announced that the merger would be completed by the end of the year, and it became clear that he wanted the new company to bid for Yugansknyftegaz. When the auction and opening price were announced at the end of 2004, he turned to Germany's Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, to help arrange the as much as $10 billion in financing that would be required for the purchase. The bank that led the consortium was Dresdner, whose managing director in Russia was Matthias Warnig, the former Stasi agent who had befriended Putin in the early 1990s and remained a liaison in the many deals being hashed out between German and Russian companies. Gazprom, with another Putin aide, Alexei Miller, serving as chief executive, did not seem as enthusiastic. The company remained skeptical about absorbing Yugansknyftegaz on top of merging with Rosneft. It was already struggling with debt and the looming expenses needed to modernize. Igor Sechin, on the other side, had his own ideas about creating the energy giant that Putin favored. That July, Putin had appointed him the chairman of Rosneft, then the country's fifth largest oil company, and now Sechin had grand visions to make it, not Gazprom, the country's leading energy company. That meant keeping it from being swallowed by Gazprom and acquiring Yukos's besieged assets for Rosneft alone. As soon as the merger was announced in September, Sechin and Rosneft's chief executive, Sergei Bogdanchikov, worked behind the scenes to scuttle it, and that is exactly what they managed to do, though not in the way anyone expected. Meanwhile, Yukos's shareholders and managers, many of whom were now safely abroad, had not yet given up their fight to block the auction and somehow preserve the company. Knowing they had little hope in the Russian courts, their lawyers filed for bankruptcy in faraway Texas 6 days before the auction of Yugansknyftegaz. It was an act of desperation, with only shaky legal grounds for a Russian company with little connection to Texas. But the next day, a judge issued a temporary restraining order, intended to block the auction until she considered the merits of the filing. The order could not stop the Russian government from proceeding, but it did affect the foreign banks lining up the loans for the auction. Like the ruling by Ukraine's Supreme Court barely 2 weeks before, the restraining order upset Putin's carefully calculated plans, and he reacted angrily, mocking the judge. "I am not sure this court even knows where Russia is," he said, and fuming at the audacity of an American court interfering in what he considered to be the internal business of the Russian state. To make his point, he cited, in Latin, the core principle of state sovereignty from ancient Roman law. Par in parem non abet imperium. An equal has no authority over an equal. Putin's outburst betrayed a sense of grievance and anger that he had mostly kept in check on issues outside of Chechnya. Now he was lashing out. The judge in Texas ultimately dismissed the filing on jurisdictional grounds, but by then her order had had its intended effect. Fearing legal liability in the United States, the international bankers withdrew the financing they had lined up for Gazprom to buy Yukos's assets through a new company created in anticipation of the merger called Gazpromneft, which was then still just an empty structure. To protect itself, Gazprom officially divested itself from the new firm, but this shell company pressed ahead anyway when the auction took place that Sunday, even though it no longer had any cash to use for the purchase. At the auction, two officials from Gazpromneft sat at one table, while at another table sat a man and a woman few people knew. They did not identify themselves, but they represented a company called Baikal Finance Group. The woman turned out to be Valentina Davletgareva, who had registered the company 13 days before in Tver, a city southeast of Moscow. She listed its address as an old hotel that now housed a mobile phone shop and declared its capital at the equivalent of $359. 3 days before the auction, the company submitted a deposit of $1.7 billion. The auction itself was theatrical. The auctioneer wore a tuxedo with tails and a bow tie. Wielding a gavel, he invited the first bid. Davletgareva's companion, Igor Minibayev, raised his hand and offered $9.37 billion. Gazpromneft's representative asked for a recess and promptly left the room to take a phone call. When he returned, he said nothing, and the auctioneer brought the hammer down. The whole thing lasted 10 minutes. No one outside Putin's Kremlin knew who now owned Yukos's crown jewel, not even the head of the property fund who had just sold it. The auction recalled the murky privatizations of the 1990s. For all Putin's promises to the contrary, the state was resorting to the same tactics to divvy up property on the cheap, this time having seized it back from private hands. One of the sharpest critiques of the auction came from Stanislav Belkovsky, who only a year before had been one of the political strategists warning the Kremlin of an oligarchic coup. Now he said the auction of Yugansk-Neftigaz was just a deal for the redistribution of property by a criminal group with a mission to get control over the basic financial flows of the country, just as in the 1990s. He called Putin the chief of this criminal group. Even more surprising was a rebuke from within Putin's administration. Andrei Ilarionov, the Kremlin's economic advisor, described the sale as a disturbing turning point for Russia, though he was careful to avoid criticizing the president personally. For the past 13 years, Russia was seeking to return to the First World, to which it belonged until the Bolshevik Revolution. Now we see it has preferred the Third World, he said at a press conference. We have passed the crossroads. We are in a different country. He was promptly demoted from his job preparing for the G8 meeting to be held in Scotland the following June. For a couple of days afterward, the fate of Yugansk-Neftigaz became a parlor game in Moscow. Many analysts assumed, wrongly, that Baikal Finance was a front to protect the ultimate buyer, Gazprom. Putin, in Germany for a state visit with Gerhard Schroeder, spoke coyly 2 days after the auction, giving away nothing, though he acknowledged that he knew the company had been hastily created to help deflect the potential liability from the lawsuit swirling around Yukos. As is well known, the shareholders of this company are all private individuals, but they are individuals who have been involved in business in the energy sphere for many years, he said when asked about the mysterious buyers. They intend, as far as I am informed, to establish relations with other energy companies in Russia which have an interest in their company. He was dissembling. The day before, Rosneft had sought and, with Putin's blessing, received authorization from Russia's Anti-Monopoly Committee to purchase Baikal Finance Group. Rosneft, which only weeks before had seemed destined for absorption into Gazprom, now owned a vastly undervalued subsidiary able to pump 1 million barrels of oil a day. On December 23rd, 4 days after the auction, Rosneft announced its purchase. It would take another year to untangle the complicated financing involved. The mysterious and short-lived Baikal Finance had received the advance for the auction from another oil company with close relations to Putin and the Kremlin, Surgutneftegaz. It was repaid once Rosneft acquired the auctioned asset, which even at its discounted price was worth more than Rosneft itself. Rosneft in turn struck a deal with China's state oil company, CNPC, to put up the cash as prepayment for the oil that Rosneft stood to derive from Yukos's seized assets. The irony was that Mikhail Khodorkovsky had long advocated developing a strategic partnership with China, even building a pipeline to the country, only to be blocked by the Kremlin, which remained wary of the rising economic power of Beijing. Now Rosneft, with Igor Sechin on its board, had effectively acquired Yukos's confiscated asset for nothing except the promise to pay that asset's future profits to China. It was, as Andrei Ilyaronov called it, the swindle of the year. Facing a new storm of international criticism, Putin defended the auction with a swaggering confidence, calculating that the initial furor over Yukos would dissipate and that no one could do anything about it anyway. At his annual press conference that December, he smugly brushed aside questions with coy elisions and evasions. Now, regarding the acquisition by Rosneft of the well-known asset of the company, I do not remember its exact name, is it Baikal Investment Company? Essentially, Rosneft, a 100% state-owned company, has bought the well-known asset Yugansknyftegaz. That is the story. In my view, everything was done according to the best market rules. As I have said, I think it was at a press conference in Germany, a state-owned company, or rather companies with 100% state capital, just as any other market players, have the right to do so, and, as it emerged, exercised it. He lamented again the 1990s, when oligarchs, using all sorts of stratagems, managed to amass state assets worth many billions. It was different now, he went on. Today, the state, resorting to absolutely legal market mechanisms, is looking after its own interests. The last statement was widely quoted in the media, but the ultimate significance of it was little noticed at the time. Eventually, it would come to haunt Putin and cost Russia billions. Mikhail Khodorkovsky's trial dragged on for another 5 months, as prosecutors read through copious financial records and questioned witnesses. The evidence was scant and contradictory, and in some cases clearly fabricated. It did not matter. The outcome by now was preordained. The court repeatedly rejected the defense's motions, refused to allow subpoenas, and restricted its questioning. On April 11th, Khodorkovsky stood before the court and made a final statement. He declared his innocence and for 39 minutes spoke passionately, defiantly, righteously. He called himself a patriot of Russia who was prosecuted not for any real criminal offenses, but for being the wrong kind of oligarch. Unlike the modest businessmen and government officials behind the Yukos affair, bureaucrats with lifestyles incommensurate with their official salaries, he said, I have no yachts, no palaces, race cars, or football clubs. The destruction of Yukos was contrived by certain influential people with the aim of taking for themselves the most prosperous oil company of Russia, or more precisely, the revenues from its financial flows. He suggested that Putin had been deceived into believing Khodorkovsky posed a political threat whose removal was necessary to protect the state's interests. Those people who are busily plundering Yukos' assets today do not actually have anything to do with the Russian state and its interests. They are simply dirty, self-serving bureaucrats and nothing else. The entire country knows why I was locked up in jail, so that I wouldn't interfere with the plunder of the company. The court of history would vindicate him, he said. He finished by thanking those who had supported him, especially his wife, who stood by him courageously, like a real Decembrist's wife. Once the final verdict was read in full over 2 weeks in May, the historical allusion seemed apt. With his partner, Platon Lebedev, he was convicted and sentenced to 9 years in prison. And like the military officers who rose up against Tsar Nicholas I in 1825, he was banished to Siberia, to a penal colony in Chita, a region bordering China and Mongolia, even though the law required prisoners to be incarcerated in the region where they committed their crimes. A few days after he arrived, his business partners paid for a full-page advertisement in the Financial Times with a defiant letter from Khodorkovsky. They hope Khodorkovsky will be soon forgotten, it declared. They are trying to convince you, my friends, that the fight is over, that we must resign ourselves to the supremacy of self-serving bureaucrats. That's not true. The fight is just beginning. The final acquisition of Yugansknyftegaz by Rosneft upended Putin's plan to create a single energy giant. Gazprom had lost the financing to allow it to take over the asset and worried about the legal risks of doing so. Rosneft, though, had no exposed assets outside of Russia that could be at risk if it violated the Texas court's ruling. Rosneft, now an oil giant on its own, worked assiduously to stay independent. That is, to avoid the merger with Gazprom. Putin ended up in the middle of an internal struggle over the state's most important assets, pitting Medvedev and Miller at Gazprom on one side versus Igor Sechin and Rosneft on the other. The unseemly conflict spilled into public view in a way few others inside the Kremlin had, and it ended only in the spring of 2005, when Putin decided on a compromise that allowed each faction to keep control of its respective company. The dismantling of Yukos may not have gone exactly according to plan, perhaps, but it had proved remarkably successful. Putin weathered the warnings from outside economists and even insiders like Ilya Ronov that the Kremlin's centralization of business would damage Russia's standing as a reliable place for business and foreign investment. He simply repeated that the country welcomed and encouraged investment, even as the organs of the state expanded even deeper into the economy. The Yukos affair did taint Russia's reputation, sowing distrust and fear of the risks of investing in the country. But in the 3 years after the assault began, Russia's stock market had more than tripled in value anyway. The economy continued its robust growth, its gross domestic product surging 6 or 7% a year on average. Over time, the consternation over Khodorkovsky's fate and that of Yukos grew fainter and fainter. The potential riches Russia had to offer proved too irresistible to the world's energy and financial giants, and so to Putin's counterparts in foreign capitals. Despite their public remonstrations over the state of democracy or the rule of law, they could not afford to ignore Russia. Why should Putin worry if some question the state's methods? Russia is a dynamically growing market with large capacity, he told a group of American and other foreign executives inside a marbled conference room at the resplendent Constantine Palace in Petersburg in June 2005, less than a month after Khodorkovsky's sentencing. I am sure that we can provide investors, including yourselves, with good working conditions and impressive profits. Putin sounded like Russia's pitchman. Sanford Weil, the chairman of Citigroup, had conceived this meeting after a previous one with Putin in February. Among those attending were 11 of the most important chief executives in the United States, including Craig Barrett of Intel, Elaine Belda of Alcoa, Samuel Palmisano of IBM, James Mulva of ConocoPhillips, and Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation. All had major investments in Russia and wanted more. Weil wanted Putin to clarify the rules of the road for investors. But instead, Putin chided the men for various restrictions that the United States imposed on trade with Russia, including export controls on space, computer, and military technology, and an amendment passed by Congress in 1974 in retaliation for the Soviet Union's restriction of emigration by Jews to Israel. Russia had long since dismantled the barriers to emigration, but the United States in the 1990s never got around to taking off the books the trade sanctions it had opposed 3 decades before, even as president after president waived their use. It would be funny if it were not so sad, Putin told them. He encouraged an expansion of trade, but placed on these men the task of straightening out the rules back home first. When the meeting concluded, the executives gathered around to greet Putin and to pose for photographs, all smiling. Weil at one point turned to Robert Kraft, the head of the Kraft Group and owner of the New England Patriots, which had won football's Super Bowl in February. "Why don't you show the president your ring?" he urged him. Kraft did not often wear his, but carried it with him in his suit pocket. The ring was a gaudy bauble, studded with 124 diamonds, and engraved with Kraft's name. He handed it to Putin, who then slipped it on a finger. "I could kill somebody with this," Putin said, admiringly. As the photo session ended, Kraft held out his hand for the ring, but Putin slipped it instead into his pocket, turned with his aides, and left. Putin apparently assumed the ring was intended as a gift, and Kraft was flustered by the misunderstanding. He appealed to Weil and later the White House for help retrieving the ring, but by then articles and photographs had appeared in the media, and an aide at the White House, fearful of the growing strains with the Kremlin, explained that it would be best for relations if Kraft would say he had intended it as a gift. I really didn't, Kraft explained. I had an emotional tie to the ring. It has my name on it. I don't want to see it on eBay. The aide was silent for a moment and repeated, It would really be in the best interest if you meant to give the ring as a present. Kraft obliged with a statement 4 days after the meeting, saying the ring was a symbol of the respect and admiration that I have for the Russian people and the leadership of President Putin. It was a cost of doing business in Russia, but the misunderstanding gnawed at Kraft for years afterward. Of course, his forebears were probably raped and pillaged by these people, his wife later said, referring to Kraft's Jewish ancestry, but Robert had to make it sound good. Kraft had another ring made, and the original went into the Kremlin Library, where gifts to the head of state are collected. The Yukos affair did not, as some feared, augur the renationalization of all of Russia's newly privatized industries, especially those tapping Russia's natural resources, but it was a turning point and a model for the steady encroachment of the state into the country's important industries. Putin identified scores of enterprises that, by law, could not be held in private hands, and then began overseeing the creation of giant state corporations that would consolidate entire sectors and thus command the nation's economy. He put in charge of them the men he had brought with him from Petersburg, many of whom continue to serve as ministers in his government while carrying out their corporate responsibilities. Their corporate positions provided access to cash flows and the opportunity for patronage. In addition to Igor Sechin at Rosneft, suddenly Russia's second largest oil producer, and within a year the largest, Sergei Ivanov, then the defense minister, took over as chairman of United Aircraft Corporation, created to consolidate civilian and military aircraft manufacturers. Vladimir Yakunin became the head of Russian railways, sometimes called the country's third natural monopoly after oil and gas. Sergei Chemezov, who had known Putin since they worked together in Dresden, took over the consolidated arms manufacturer Rosatomexport. According to one estimate, by 2006, the revenues of the state companies accounted for a fifth of the country's GDP and a third of the value of its stock markets, and Putin's friends and allies controlled them. The most powerful of all remained Gazprom. Neither Dmitry Medvedev, its chairman, nor Alexei Miller, its chief executive, was installed for his particular experience or expertise in natural gas management. Both were chosen for their loyalty. Through them, Putin pulled the reins at Gazprom, involving himself in the minutiae of the company's budgets, pricing, pipeline routes, and even personnel, which he approved, down to the deputy level, sometimes without telling Miller about important appointments. It became such an obsession of Putin's that many wondered whether he was preparing to take over the company when his presidential term ended. Thank you for the job offer, he replied in January 2006 when a journalist asked him the question directly. However, I am not likely to head a business. I am not a businessman, either by character or by previous life experience. Gazprom may have lost the internal jockeying to seize Yukos's main asset, but it continued its quest to expand, and did so with tactics more stealthy and subtle than the expropriation of Yukos. Roman Abramovich, having abandoned Sibnieft's merger with Yukos in 2003 after meeting with Putin, while keeping the $3 billion Khodorkovsky paid him, also found his company facing new tax claims. Facing a $1 billion bill, he quietly negotiated a settlement in 2005 for $300 million and promptly sought to sell his controlling stake of the company. He considered offers from Chevron Texaco, Shell, and Total, but he was savvier than Khodorkovsky, or at least less confrontational, and he could read the writing on the wall. In July 2005, Sibnieft paid an enormous dividend of $2.29 billion to its shareholders, more than its entire profit 2 years before, in what was clearly a sign that Abramovich was cashing out and preparing the company for sale. 2 days later, at the meeting of G8 leaders in Scotland, Putin confirmed the speculation and acknowledged that Gazprom was the suitor. He insisted that it was a private matter between businesses, but also divulged that he had personally been involved in discussions with Abramovich. Gazprom did not have the cash to acquire Sibneft, but Putin announced that the government would buy enough of Gazprom's shares to give the state majority control, using funds from the state's coffers. Gazprom then used the infusion of cash to purchase Sibneft for $13 billion, a price so inflated that speculation swirled about the kickbacks that must have been involved. The American ambassador at the time, William J. Burns, cabled the State Department that only a quarter was said to have gone to Abramovich himself. Many others, it seemed, took a share too. By Putin's second term, Gazprom, once a sclerotic behemoth, had emerged as the energy giant he dreamed of. It became one of the largest corporations in the world by market capitalization, bypassing stalwarts like Toyota, Walmart, and Sanford Weill's Citigroup. It had not become any more efficient or well-managed, but Putin made it the country's most powerful business, and a powerful arm of the country's foreign policy from Asia to Europe. With Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, a leader and friend who had once called him a flawless Democrat, Putin orchestrated a deal to construct the longest underwater natural gas pipeline in the world, connecting terminals in Russia to those in Germany. The project, eventually known as Nord Stream, would bypass the old Soviet pipeline network through Ukraine, Belarus, and Poland, giving the Kremlin leverage in negotiations over transit fees in those countries and increasing Europe's dependence on Russia. It was deeply controversial. Poland's defense minister called it the energy version of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, while environmentalists along the Baltic Sea warned of the potential damage of running pipelines along a sea floor littered with munitions from both world wars. When Schroeder was ousted from office in elections that year, Putin appointed him chairman of the shareholders' committee of the new subsidiary that would build Nord Stream, only days after the German had blessed the project with a secret loan guarantee worth 1 billion euros. Gazprom owned a controlling stake, along with Germany's two major energy companies, BASF and E.ON, and Putin was in the position to dispense the perquisites. The managing director of the pipeline project, appointed with his blessing, was his old Stasi friend, Matthias Warnig. A week after hiring Schroeder, Putin summoned Donald Evans, an oil man and confidant of President Bush, who had served as Secretary of Commerce during Bush's first term, to an unexpected meeting at the Kremlin, and offered him a similar position at Rosneft, hoping to give an international legitimacy to the company that now existed on the pilfered remains of Yukos. Evans passed, but Putin had come to believe it was ultimately money that drove men and politics. In Europe especially, many proved him right. Despite disavowing any business acumen, Putin reveled in the details of the country's biggest deals, negotiating himself and mediating disputes. In July 2005, Royal Dutch Shell acknowledged a staggering cost overrun in the oil and gas project on Sakhalin Island in the Far East, the product of the country's first production-sharing agreement signed in the 1990s, only a week after signing a memorandum of understanding with Gazprom to include the giant in the project. During a state visit to the Netherlands in November, Putin publicly berated the company's chief executive, Jeroen van der Veer, at a meeting with businessmen in the home of Amsterdam's mayor. Van der Veer had to plead for time at the reception to meet with Putin privately, and the two spent 20 minutes arguing in German about why a $10 billion project had ballooned to $20 billion, delaying significantly any profits the Russian government would receive. Van der Veer tried to explain that the massive project, which included offshore platforms and hundreds of miles of pipeline, required expertise and technologies for producing liquefied natural gas that neither Gazprom nor other Russian companies had. The project would still be profitable despite the rising cost, but Putin demanded that the agreement with Gazprom be renegotiated anyway. When those talks dragged on for months, the Kremlin unleashed the Ministry of Natural Resources environmental watchdog, Alek Mitvol, who carried out a highly publicized assault on the project for its damage to the environment. That there was an environmental impact on Sakhalin, to salmon estuaries, and the breeding grounds of gray whales in the Sea of Okhotsk, was certainly true, but preservation of wildlife had never been such a priority before. Mitvol now threatened to open a criminal case for every tree that had been cut down, making an outlandish estimate that Shell could face $50 billion in fines and fees. Shell, which owned the project with Mitsu and Company, and Mitsubishi Corporation in Japan, took the hint. It not only acquiesced to a new agreement, but sold a controlling share of the entire project to Gazprom for $7.45 billion, considerably below market price. At Putin's insistence, van der Veer then had to return to the Kremlin with the executives of Mitsu and Mitsubishi to validate the agreement before the cameras, a ceremony intended to show that Putin's mastery extended beyond Russian officials and businessmen. "All the world's largest companies are benefiting from their work in Russia," Putin told those gathered around a table in a conference room near his office. As for the massive environmental damage, Putin said the issue would be regarded as almost settled in principle. The foreign executives had lost control of the project, but they kept the oil and gas reserves on their books and millions in profits for their companies. And so, one by one, they welcomed Gazprom as the project's new owner and thanked Putin for his efforts to support international partnership, just as Kraft had. Each new acquisition emboldened Putin. At the end of 2005, Gazprom hiked the price of natural gas it delivered to Ukraine from a heavily discounted $50 per 1,000 cubic meters to $230, in line with prices charged in the rest of Europe. The increase was transparent retribution for Yushchenko's flirtation with the West after taking power. Putin had negotiated the lower price ahead of the election, hoping to boost Yanukovych's prospects, but now, with the contract up for renewal and Yushchenko orienting the country toward Europe, Putin would make Ukraine pay more. It was not politics, Putin insisted, just business, but he sounded spiteful. "Why should we pay for that?" he said of Ukraine's embrace of the West. On New Year's Eve, Putin offered a 3-month reprieve and a loan to help Ukraine cope. But when the country continued to balk, Gazprom shut off the gas on New Year's Day with Putin's blessing. As a hardball tactic, it backfired. Since most of Russia's natural gas to Europe flowed through pipelines traversing Ukraine, the decision rippled across the continent at the height of winter. Instead of letting the rest of Russia's gas continue to flow to Europe, Ukraine siphoned off what it needed, causing disruptions in pressure in Austria, France, Italy, Moldova, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and Hungary. Russia had principle on its side, but Putin's tactics rattled even those who had argued that Russia deserved respect. He also undermined his own strategy of showing Europe that Russia would be a dependable and indispensable energy source. Putin had to retreat. He offered a compromise that would raise gas prices overall, but install as a middleman Rosukrenergo, the shadowy trading company he had created with Leonid Kuchma in the months before the Orange Revolution. Gazprom owned half of it. The other owners, who remained secret then, included Dmitry Firtash, a Ukrainian businessman who acknowledged ties to one of the world's most notorious mob bosses, Semyon Mogilevich. Mogilevich, who was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list because of a fraud case, had deep contacts with Ukraine's government, including Yushchenko, and was said to have known Putin in the 1990s. According to one of the taped recordings of Kuchma, he lived in Moscow under a false identity with Putin's protection, in exchange for having worked as an intelligence agent for the Russians. The agreement gave Gazprom even greater control over Ukraine's gas supply, which might have been the point of the dispute in the first place, securing Russia's control inside a country bent on turning away from it. The terms of the deal and the murky ties between the middleman company and Yushchenko and his allies provoked a political furor in Ukraine that Putin easily exploited. When asked, he suggested that it was the Ukrainian leader who was behind the shadowy owners of Rosukrenergo. "Ask Viktor Yushchenko," he said. "I don't know any more than you do, and Gazprom does not know either, believe me." Putin was having his cake and eating it too. Gazprom got half the profits of selling its own natural gas to Ukraine, while Yushchenko was tarred with the implication of corrupt ties to a deal that was so controversial at home that it split the coalition that had led the Orange Revolution. By the time Ukraine held parliamentary elections in March 2006, Yulia Tymoshenko, the gas princess who had her own experience with the energy trade in Ukraine, railed against the agreement and the president she had helped win office. As a result, Yushchenko's party fared dismally, forcing him to seek a new coalition with the man he had beaten, Viktor Yanukovych, who now began his political comeback. It was becoming unclear where the affairs of state and business diverged. People in Russia started to call the government Kremlin Inc., with Putin as the CEO. He presided over not just Gazprom, but all the national champions at home, granting prerogatives that included protection from tax inspectors, who were often unleashed against other businesses, small and large. And he lobbied for their interests abroad with a zeal that would have been unimaginable coming from Yeltsin in the 1990s. By 2005, the extent of his control over the state's monopolies became evident, and it coincided with the elimination of the last political checks against his power in the parliament or the judiciary. Putin, who had vowed to eliminate the brash oligarchs as a class, had become the patron of a growing part of Russia's economy. He did not dictate every business deal across Russia, but all the major ones required at least tacit approval from the Kremlin. The oligarchs from the 1990s, who survived the transition to the Putin era, showed their obsequiousness with acts of fealty and charity, as when Viktor Vekselberg bought and repatriated 9 of the famous Fabergé eggs, or the bells of the Danilov Monastery that rang for nearly a century at Harvard University's Lowell House. There were certainly other acts few knew about, quiet exchanges of favors and gifts done to preserve their fortunes. One that had been meant to be secret would eventually leak out, providing a rare glimpse of how fortunes were made behind the scenes. In 2000, Nikolai Shomolov, one of Putin's colleagues in the Azara Dacha Cooperative at Lake Komsomolskaya, struck a deal with the owners of a small medical supply company that Putin's committee in Petersburg had helped create in 1992. It was called Petromed, and though the city of Petersburg eventually sold its majority shares, the company had flourished. Shomolov arranged with its owners to accept donations from oligarchs who were coming forward to offer help to the new president. Roman Abramovich pledged $203 million, for example, while Alexei Mordashov, the owner of the metal and mining conglomerate Severstal, offered $15 million. The donations would be used to purchase medical equipment, but part of the receipts would be funneled into offshore bank accounts that were then used to acquire other assets in Russia, including, allegedly, shares in Bank Rossiya. The arrangement started out relatively small and entirely secret, but by 2005, Shomolov told the owners of Petromed that the proceeds from the donations, estimated by then to amount to nearly $500 million, would now be funneled from the offshore accounts into a new investment company in Russia called Rosinvest. And its principal investment became the construction of a luxury home on the Black Sea coast near Sochi, where Soviet rulers had vacationed in luxury and Putin already had the run of the presidential retreat. The home would be a palace fit for a czar, with an estimated cost of $1 billion. None of this became public at the time. It was known only to a few businessmen and government officials who were discreet enough or corrupt enough not to divulge what was going on. It was here in the murky nexus where the state met business, that a new class of oligarch would emerge from the shadow periphery of the economy and from Putin's past. Yuri Kovalchuk, the physicist Putin had worked with in some of Petersburg's early experiments in capitalism, had continued to operate Bank Russia, an institution founded in the Soviet era. In the early part of the decade, it remained little more than a small provincial institution, handling the assets of its shareholders with no discernible part in the economic boom that followed Putin's rise to power. The bank, however, united the circle of men Putin had befriended in the 1990s, and with whom he remained close even after his political fortunes catapulted him far higher than anyone expected, including his partners in the Dacha Cooperative. Like their fortunes, the cooperative had grown with Putin's rise, expanding at the expense of neighbors, allegedly in order to install the necessary security measures. The owners faced legal challenges from neighbors who complained that their access to the lake had been expropriated. One complained that the cooperative's head, Vladimir Smirnov, whom Putin had appointed to head the nuclear export agency, had throttled her when she tried to exercise her right of way to the shore by crossing through a fence. By the end of his first term, though, Putin was said to have sold his share, having far more ambitious plans for his own personal space. Some of the dacha owners, like Smirnov, had followed Putin to Moscow to take on public roles in the government. Andrei Fursenko became a deputy minister, then Minister of Industry, Science, and Technology, and finally, in 2004, Minister of Education and Science. Vladimir Yakunin took over Russian Railways in 2005. Others, including Kovalchuk and Nikolai Shemolov, who had worked as the director in Russia for the German manufacturer Siemens, kept a much lower profile. Their bank had lost its privileged access to the government coffers after Sobchak's defeat as governor nearly a decade before. But with Putin's accession, things looked much brighter. In Putin's first term as president, men like Kovalchuk and Shamolov, along with Gennady Timchenko, all remained largely unknown. Putin's first prime minister, Mikhail Kazyanov, could not recall ever having heard the name of either the bank or its owners in the many government deals he oversaw. Kovalchuk's name surfaced in connection with Putin's only in 2004, coincidentally the month Kazyanov was fired, when the doomed presidential challenger, Ivan Rybkin, published an ad in Kommersant accusing Putin of being in business with him, along with Timchenko and Roman Abramovich. Rybkin's odd disappearance days later overshadowed his claims, and nobody paid much attention to these men, because on the scale of big business in Russia, they were inconsequential outsiders, minor players from the provinces. The bank reported scant profits the year Putin came to power, but like so much else in Putin's Russia, that would soon change. Kovalchuk took over as chairman of Bank Russia in 2004, after one of the country's biggest oligarchs, Alexei Mordashov of Severstal, deposited $19 million in the bank, and then took an 8.8% share in exchange. It was then the equivalent of the bank's entire capital. Many assumed Mordashov was trying to buy favor with Putin in the midst of a struggle with a business rival, as he had happily donated funds to Petromed to buy hospital equipment. With its resources swelling, the bank then quietly bought nearly half of Gazprom's insurance arm, Sogas, on the stock market in July 2004. The total sale was $58 million, which was later argued to be significantly less than its value. It was the first sale by Gazprom of one of its non-core assets. Officials and analysts had long argued that the company should sell them, but this sale seemed puzzling, especially since the bidding was closed and the buyers remained behind the scenes. Putin intervened directly in the deal, ordering that the shares go to Bank Russia. Putin said, "Bank Russia, that's it," a former deputy minister during Putin's first term, Vladimir Milov, recalled later. The liberals in his cabinet seemed shocked or confused, as Bank Russia's role in the purchase did not become public until January 2005. It now controlled Sogas through a series of shell companies, including one created in Petersburg in 2002 called Accept, which was owned by Mikhail Shalomov, the grandson of Putin's uncle, Ivan Shalomov, who had helped evacuate Putin's mother during the Nazi invasion. To those in the know, the bank clearly had a privileged status, with ties to the very top. Now, business simply flowed toward the bank. Sogas soon became the insurer of choice for major state companies like Russian Railways, headed by Yakunin, and Rosneft, now controlled by Igor Sechin. That, in turn, fueled a phenomenal expansion, as Bank Russia quietly acquired more and more of Gazprom's assets, including its banking subsidiary and ultimately its media holdings. The bank's expansion began as a stealth operation, executed patiently and secretly, its ownership structure obscured in layers of offshore companies stacked like Matryoshka nesting dolls, hiding, some would suspect, Putin's personal stakes in them. In his first term, Putin had moved slowly to set the economy on its feet, benefiting enormously from the unexpected surge in the price of oil, which in turn affected the price of natural gas. But his second term represented a significant shift, one that coincided with the departure of some of his liberal advisors and the consolidation of the Kremlin's control over the branches of government, as well as over the media and business. Now, with the country increasingly solvent, he began to redistribute the proceeds to a new generation of tycoons in waiting, those who had not had the privileged insider track to amass fortunes in the 1990s. None of them were billionaires then, flashing their wealth ostentatiously. They were a new generation of oligarchs, made in the Putin model, dour, colorless, secretive, and intensely loyal to the man who brought them out of relative obscurity. Those who had not joined Putin in the ranks of government soon followed in business. After Rosneft acquired the lion's share of Yukos, the contracts to trade much of its oil shifted to Gennady Timchenko, the trader who first made deals with Putin in the 1990s. When Arkady Rotenberg, who along with his brother Boris, had learned judo at Putin's side when they were teenagers in the 1960s, formed a judo club in Petersburg in 1998 called Yawara Niva, Timchenko provided sponsorship, and Putin became the club's honorary president. The club created a judocracy that would shape Putin's political leadership as much as the KGB did. Vasily Shestakov, another judoka and founder of the club, who had promised to hire Putin as a coach in 1996, entered politics and published books and videos on the sport, including one ostensibly co-authored by Putin. When, on the eve of his inauguration in 2000, Putin established a state company to consolidate dozens of vodka distilleries in which the government still had a controlling interest, he turned to the judocracy to control it. He put Arkady Rotenberg in charge of what was called Rospidiprom. In a country with a taste for the hard stuff, the enterprise would grow into a multi-million-dollar business, controlling nearly half the country's alcohol market, benefiting from new government regulations and raids on private rivals. Rotenberg and his brother Boris parlayed the profits of Russia's national drink into their own bank, SMP Bank, which then began investing in pipeline construction of exactly the sort Putin was negotiating with the likes of Gerhard Schroeder. Unlike the get-rich-quick schemes of the 1990s privatizations, the accumulation of assets by Putin's friends was so slow and incremental that its significance only became clear much later. Putin had enabled his circle of friends to rise to the heights of the country's economy, enriching them while ensuring they would control the sectors of the economy, from natural resources to the media, that he considered vital to the nation's security. He doesn't take the St. Petersburg boys to work with him because of their pretty eyes, but because he trusts people who are tried and true. Putin's first judo trainer, Anatoly Rakhlin, told Izvestia in 2007. On December 26, 2005, Putin gathered his advisors for a special meeting inside the Kremlin to discuss, among other issues, how to divide up the proceeds of Rosneft's extraordinary growth. Around the long oval table were the men who had been with him since Petersburg: Alexander Medvedev, Alexei Kudrin, German Greff, Igor Sechin. It was an unusual meeting, smaller than a cabinet meeting, but larger than the regular meetings devoted to economic matters. Andrei Ilarionov, already demoted once, was also there, but by then he felt increasingly uncomfortable with the direction of the Kremlin's economic policy. Ilarionov, trained as an economist, had been a pugnacious, strong-tempered advisor to Russian governments since the collapse of the Soviet Union. A libertarian and a free marketer, he had never shied away from stating his mind. The first time he met with Putin, in February 2000, while the latter was still acting president, an aide passed a note informing Putin that Russian forces in Chechnya had captured the town of Shatoy, the last stronghold then still occupied by the rebels. He was ebullient, and when Ilarionov responded by telling him the war was illegal and destructive for Russia, they argued for an hour before Putin icily cut him off. From that point on, he declared, they would never again discuss Chechnya, only economic matters. For the first term of Putin's presidency, Ilarionov felt vindicated by the economic course the country was taking. He endorsed the decisions Putin took to embrace the flat tax of 13%, pay off the country's debt, and create a stability fund of reserves, which had grown unexpectedly flush. The Yukos affair signaled something different, and he said as much. He now found that Putin no longer heeded his advice, first demoting him, then steadily shrinking his staff in the Kremlin. In an interview with the Russian opposition newspaper, The New Times, Ilarionov said that Putin had divided those around him into distinct groups. One he called the Economics Group, which involved his advisors on all matters involving the economy. The other group involved business people, from which official advisors were generally excluded. It was with those people, he said, that Putin would establish control over property and financial flows. Just as Putin declared they would no longer discuss Chechnya, he no longer seemed interested in discussing the plans for Rosneft with Ilarionov. The meeting to discuss the company's initial public offering on the London Stock Exchange and Russia's two exchanges was the first Ilarionov had been invited to on the matter, but it soon became clear to him that the plans were already well advanced. At this meeting, Igor Sechin presented the proposal to raise $12 billion in capital by selling 13% of the company's shares and then using the proceeds to pay off debt and invest in new projects. One by one, Putin's aides then endorsed the idea. "It's fine," Greff said. Medvedev said he had verified the legality of the deal. When it came time for Ilarionov to speak, though, he objected. "If the state were going to sell a share of its largest oil company," he argued, "should not the proceeds return to the state's budget?" Putin pushed back his chair, his face reddening. Ilarionov knew that he had made him uncomfortable by pointing out the political risk involved. It was one thing to prosecute Khodorkovsky and seize Yukos's assets. Russians had cheered for that. But another altogether to not share the profits with the ultimate shareholders, the Russian people. Ilarionov now understood that the matter had already been decided by everyone in the room. Nobody joined his argument. They stared silently at the table. Even worse, he told them, not all the proceeds were intended to shore up or expand Rosneft. Under the proposal being ratified that day, $1.5 billion of the sale was earmarked for unspecified bonuses for Rosneft's management, presumably the company's executive and its board members, including Igor Sechin. This seemed to surprise Putin. He went pale and pulled his chair back to the table. "Igor Ivanovich," Putin said, turning to Sechin, "what is this?" Sechin bolted upright, standing like a conscript soldier in front of an angry officer, stammering Putin's name, according to Ilarionov. He did not, or could not explain the bonuses, and Putin simply thanked Ilarionov for his contribution to the discussion. Ilarionov, who believed that Putin had not known of the bonuses, resigned the next day, publicly criticizing the direction in which Putin was taking the country. The state has become essentially a corporate enterprise that the nominal owners, Russian citizens, no longer control, he wrote in a blistering editorial in Kommersant. Ilarionov's opposition served to delay the IPO, as Sechin and Putin debated the terms and the timing, but not for long. When the proposal was announced in early 2006, Rosneft said it hoped to raise $20 billion, though it later reduced its target to $10 billion. The government announced with fanfare that it would put individual shares up for retail sale through the state bank, Sberbank, and others, trying to portray this privatization as a benefit for ordinary Russians, who would also have the chance to share in the country's energy boom. The main focus, though, was on enlisting international energy companies, including BP, Petronas, and China's giant CNPC, who were enticed by the prospect of a new foothold in Russia's energy market, if only as minority shareholders. When the results of the offering seemed low, other Russian oligarchs, including Roman Abramovich, stepped in with large purchases, presumably at the prompting of the Kremlin, so that Rosneft would hit its target. The offering was as controversial as the Yukos affair, and a risk for Putin personally, since it amounted to a test of the brand of capitalism he was managing. To float shares in London required a full disclosure of the risks to investors. Rosneft's disclosure, in fact, acknowledged the crime and corruption in Russia and the likelihood that Yukos-related lawsuits would hound the company into the distant future. It also made it clear that Kremlin Inc. remained the ultimate arbiter of the company's fate. The Russian government, whose interests may not coincide with those of other shareholders, controls Rosneft and may cause Rosneft to engage in business practices that do not maximize shareholder value, the prospectus acknowledged. Whether the bonuses Ilarionov criticized were paid was never made public, and the interest of institutional investors remained lukewarm. But the offering was the fifth largest in history. It raised $10.7 billion, and at the selling price of the shares, Rosneft was valued at nearly $80 billion. The offering took place not by coincidence on the eve of the G8 summit, which was being held for the first time in Petersburg, with Putin as the host. The Kremlin prepared an ambitious agenda that included Russia's place as the guarantor of energy security, despite the conflict with Ukraine and later Georgia and Belarus over natural gas. Rosneft's rise proved that Russia had righted itself again, and in the run-up to the summit, Putin exuded a confidence, even a swagger, that had appeared for a time to have been tempered by the horrors of Beslan, the contagion of popular uprisings, and the rising criticism of Russia's course. "The market," Sechin declared in the company's next annual report, "has spoken."